on radio, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is InvestTalk, above average investing for the average investor. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, KPP Financial Executive Vice President, Financial Advisor Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to InvestTalk. This is our Monday, November 23rd edition of InvestTalk, and we are here to talk about your money, how you spend it, how you save it, and most importantly, how you invest it. Now, we like to call this Better Than Average Investing for the Average Investor. That's the title of Steve's book, by the way. And we want to help you get above the ranks of the average investor. Because the average investor, they make a lot of mistakes. They invest with their heart and their emotions rather than facts and figures. So who is the average investor? Now, well, the average investor is someone who looks at the market rising and then, you know, opens their purse and pours money into the market because they're chasing. The average person looks at one or two things to make their decision. The average person follows what they see in the media, follows what Jim Cramer has to say, who follows tips from their friends or their family. And then when the market slumps, the average investor usually overreacts. They sell, they get nervous. Why? Because they don't have a plan. They don't have an understanding of how to develop a view of a particular company, particular sector, the economy as a whole, or the market as a whole. Now, as you would expect, the average investor usually loses more than they make. And then eventually they usually swear off investing until the next boom. And then they want to get back in and get in on the action. And it's just a poor strategy. And really it's because there's a lack of strategy. Just kind of, let's do a little of this here, a little bit there. They usually end up with too many stocks in their portfolio, too many positions, no real rhyme or reason why. So our goal is to help you break out of this pattern and remove the barriers that are inherently there so that you can succeed. And what are those barriers? Human emotion, number one. Number two, data, real perspective. Balanced perspective. You know, the media always talks about the either the really good or the really bad. They don't usually talk about the in-between. But guess what? Most stocks, most assets are usually somewhere in between doing great and doing terrible. But in the media, you usually only hear about the ones, about the companies and sectors that are doing great or doing terrible. Now, many people struggle and they repeatedly make these same investing mistakes. And the reason is because they're not identifying what is keeping them from being successful. And that is our goal, is to get rid of the emotions, the fear and greed many individual experience that clouds their judgment and clouds rationale. Now, for example, investors hate to sell winners and are reluctant to buy out-of-favor stocks. Then there are those investors who hold on to losing investments for way too long, hoping that the shares recover, and really no reason why the shares might recover. They just hope. Hope is not a strategy. Now, the second barrier, no surprise, is lack of knowledge. So many people, most people, they went to school for something besides investing, something besides finance or economics. Now, that doesn't mean you can't be successful if you didn't, but that isn't your basis of area of expertise. It takes a while to get there, to build that knowledge base, to understand the ebbs and flows of the market, the terminology, how they all work together, and how to think dynamically. And what I mean that is, okay, if, say, for example, the dollar gets stronger, what type of companies are going to benefit? What type of companies aren't going to benefit? And then you go based on industry, and then you drill down into individual companies. How might companies then react? And might that affect another industry? What about interest rates? The Fed is probably going to raise interest rates in December, at least as of probably now. Things could change. But that's probably what's going to happen in December. What industries does that affect? What industries does it help? What industries does it hurt? And then will money flow from one industry to another? See how dynamic and complex it can be? For me, and Steve, I mean, you know, professionals, we do it all the time. It's like second nature. And that's what it needs to become to you, and that's why you're here listening, because you want to get more knowledge. So call in. Ask your questions. We want to drop those barriers. Get rid of those barriers for you so that you can become more successful, losing less and winning more. Obviously, our goal, everyone's goal. So let's talk about it. We want to hear from you. 888-99-CHART. That is our anytime number.
This is Todd from Seattle. I listen on your podcast. And I'm wondering about moving averages. My question is, what time frame of a chart do you generally look at when you're looking at an indicator like moving averages? I've noticed that when you look at a different length of a chart, say 1 year versus 6 months versus 5 days, that the technical indicators like moving averages look quite different. So I'm wondering just what general time frame you guys use when you're looking at indicators like that. Thanks very much. Bye.
That is a great question. Love the question. He's asking about moving averages. And moving averages are basically the average price for that particular stock or index over that time period. What's the 50-day moving average? It's the average of the last 50 days, 100 days. Okay, so that's the basics of it. Then he's asking what time frame. Well, all time frames matter. But what I always say is the longer the time frame, the better. So the moving averages on a weekly are more important than moving averages on a daily. Moving averages on a monthly are more important than moving averages on a weekly, and so on. You know, you go in the short term, a 10-minute moving average, you know, we go intraday. Most professionals can go intraday. Average person, you know, it's kind of hard to get intraday charts. But the daily chart moving averages are more important than a 60-minute chart or a 10-minute chart moving average. So all of them matter. It's just a matter of how much do they matter versus something else. And I always say, look at the bigger the time frame, the more important the moving average or the chart pattern is. All right. 888-99-CHART is our number. 888-992-4278 is the number to get through and ask your question on this Monday edition of Invest Talk. And let's take a quick look at today's market. We had the Dow down 31 points, the NASDAQ down 3, and the S&P down 2. Very modest down day. You have gold up a little bit, oil up a little bit. It was kind of a know-nothing day, a do-nothing day, shall I say. So I wouldn't take really much out of this. We're still kind of struggling at the highs for the S&P. Not much really going on, to be honest. There's no breakout. There's no breakdown. It's just kind of floating up here. And I would say there's probably more risk to the downside than the upside, but it's really been a modest day. And the only economic news that came out today was the housing number, the existing home sales. That was down about 3.4%. So not too hot when it comes to existing home sales. Now, a talking point today is about the big changes ahead for Social Security, claiming Social Security. We're going to talk about that. I also want to talk about the market's vital signs. Let's check in on them. Healthy, not healthy. What about the death of the American mall? What does that mean for investors? We're going to talk about that. And then earnings. S&P earnings out, about 95, 96% of them have been out already. So we're going to talk about that as well and see how healthy earnings are for this quarter. Next month, Steve will be meeting with individual listeners looking over their retirement documents and making some suggestions for them. There's no cost, no obligation to these informal meetings that Steve does a couple times a month usually at our satellite offices. The next date is in La Jolla in San Diego County on December 2nd, and then San Ramon in Northern California on December 9th. You can reserve your hour by clicking on schedule a meeting on investtalk.com.
I have a question regarding short ratios and short percent of float. Tell me a little bit about what those mean, and when you're evaluating a company, what numbers you would look for. What do those exactly mean, and what numbers do you look for when evaluating a company? Thank you. My name is John, and I listen to you on podcasts.
All right, he's looking at short interest and short ratio. Well, the short interest is the number of days based on average daily volume that it would take to cover how many shares are outstanding short, okay? So for example, give you a simple example. Say the stock trades on average a million shares a day, and they usually use the 50-day average, what the average trading volume was for the last 50 days. Say it was a million shares, right? And the short interest is 5 days. Well, that means 5 million shares are short, meaning 5 million shares have been borrowed to sell short on this particular stock. And then the percentage of the float is, okay, what percentage of the shares in the float are short? So use that same example. Let's say there are 50 million shares in the float. And the float is, there's total amount of shares outstanding, right, for the company. But think of buybacks. When a company goes and buys the shares back and puts them on their balance sheet, well, those shares aren't out there to be traded. They're not really trading in brokerage accounts or in mutual funds, etc., right? So the amount in the float is what is out there being traded on a regular basis, or can be traded anyway. So say there's 5 million shares short, and it's in the float is 50 million shares. Well, that's a 10% of the float is short, right? So that's how you calculate that. Now, how should you think about that? How should that matter to you in context? Well, the higher the short interest, higher the percentage of the float, the bigger chance there is for a potential short covering rally. KBIO is a great example of this. This is a recent biotech stock. It went from $4 to $40 in a very short span because it was a big short covering rally. Now, that can be a good thing if you want to buy it, meaning, hey, if something great happens to the company unexpectedly, there's a lot of shares short that they're going to have to cover, and that could drive the price up quickly. But it also could mean that somebody knows how bad, something worse about this company than you're probably seeing, and there's a lot of people in the know that are shorting it. So there's two ways to kind of think about it. Now, our Invest Talk Anytime number is there for you. 888-99-CHART is how do you get through. Give us a call. This is Invest Talk.
Thanks again for subscribing to our podcast. Debt, it turns out, can be kind of a friend, even if it's just that flaky friend that you can't really trust. When it may be smart to be in debt, that's one of our talking points for Tuesday's podcast. We hope you'll be able to join us then.
888-99 chart, 888-992-4278. That's our number to get through and ask your question. We have about 35 minutes left in the show, but you know that goes by quicker than it seems. So if you're going to make a call, do it sooner rather than later. Let's talk about our main talking point today, which is claiming Social Security, and there are some big changes coming down the pipeline, and I want to talk about really the main one. And this is comes on based because of the new budget deal. Congress just passed it, a new budget, and it nixes some popular Social Security claiming strategies. And the main one is file and suspend. File and suspend. Now, file and suspend is a strategy which enables higher earning spouses to postpone the benefits of Social Security while still earning lucrative delayed retirement credits. But at the same time, their spouse is getting spousal benefits. Okay? So for example, say you have a husband and wife, and you know typically the husband has made more, sometimes not, but typically the husband has made more. So their benefit's going to be, his benefit's going to be higher. Well, what he can do is at 62, you file and suspend. And whatever that benefit is, say it's $2,000 a month, the spouse usually gets half that, $1,000, right? But you don't want to take it at 62 because you want to earn all the growth, about 8% growth per year in payouts between 62 and, you know, hopefully full retirement age and hopefully all the way to 70, right? But you can file and suspend. You're still gaining all of that growth in payouts once you finally do take your benefit. But your wife can still get spousal benefits, which are, in this example, $1,000 a month. Well, guess what? That's going away. Now, it was originally meant for older workers so that they could stay on the job. They wouldn't be forced to retire. Okay? And they can still claim some benefits. Or the wife can claim some benefits. But the strategy loophole kind of got out there and became very popular. And now the government's kind of taking aim at it. And it's really going to affect a lot of people. Now, under the new law, lower earning spouses, which are, like I said, often women, who stayed out of the workforce to care for families, may be forced to take reduced spousal benefits. Now, this only affects those who are under the age of 66 before May 1st of next year. Before 6 months after May 1st, which is, sometime around late next year. Okay. So that's, under the new strategy, the higher earner at full retirement age can still claim his benefits, and you can still get spousal benefits, but you can't delay it like you used to and keep getting that growth. So you can still do what you did before normally, but this loophole is kind of going away. So, and there's some other ones there's another one that's called restricting an application, which gets more complicated, but I don't want to get into that. But just know that there are changes to the Social Security system coming down the pipeline because of the new budget deal. Now, our phone is always open to your questions. 888-99-CHART is our anytime number.
Alex from Tracy, California. I would like to know if you believe it is the right time at this time of the year to buy stocks in oil and gas sector. And in particular, I would like to know buying ExxonMobil or British Petroleum, XOM and BP. Is it the right time to buy them, or I should wait till prices go lower? Thank you very much for the feedback.
All right, he's looking at ExxonMobil and British Petroleum, two of the largest integrated oil companies in the world. BP is market cap at $105 billion. Exxon is it roughly $300 billion? Let's see what it is. $334 billion. So it's a pretty large, both pretty large companies. Exxon's yielding about 3.6%. BP yielding about 6.9, so much, much higher. Let me take a look at their balance here, their cash flow statement, to see which one looks healthier. Because when oil's this low, right, and things do look cheap broadly, you want to see which one is healthier. Well, both have positive free cash flow, but BP is now not very profitable. Their operating income is now negative, which isn't good. Now, a lot of that could be, you know, writing down the value of assets, things like that. That certainly could be the case. So I don't want to say it's not in good health, but that, so that could be a non-cash flow thing, and that's what it kind of looks like here. Exxon, a little much, much better. We own Exxon for our managed accounts. It's the safer play. It depends on, I like them both. I think Exxon and I think oil is trying to make a bottom here. I think it does have a lot of upside. There is a lot of support in these areas. I don't think oil can go a whole lot lower. So I do like it. I do like both. But it depends on what type of risk you want to take. BP, much higher risk. But they're not, I mean, it's not crazy high risk. It's still a large company. It's still not going to go bankrupt. But it's much higher risk. So if oil goes lower, you know, you're gonna take a bigger hit on BP. Now you're listening to InvestTalk. Coming up on the next half hour, removing your barriers to investing success. Give us a call at 888-99-CHART.
This is InvestTalk for Monday, November 23rd. 888-99-CHART is how to reach us right now.
888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. Let's talk a little bit about earnings. Earnings so far this quarter, have about 96% of them have come in. And profits are down 3.3% on a share-weighted basis in the third quarter. Now, that marks the second consecutive quarter of negative earnings growth. And the main culprit really is the strong dollar. It's hurting profits, it's hurting revenue, and it's really the largest part of the problem. Now, obviously, share buybacks are kind of slowing down a little bit. The consumer is doing okay. Businesses are having more trouble. There's a lot of secular changes going on in the retail industry. The internet is really transforming the economy in a lot of ways, the sectors in a lot of ways. So there are certain companies that are not doing so well, or certain industries that are not doing so well. I think the retail industry is getting squeezed by the likes of Amazon, but Amazon's not making a ton of money. They're getting all the revenue, but profitability-wise, they're kind of stealing a lot of profits from the big box retailers, but it's not as much profit as they're stealing from them, for, you know what I mean? So the margins that Amazon's making are lower than usually the margins that these big box retailers were making. So there is a dynamic shift going on, and the trend is really set to continue in the fourth quarter. Analysts are expecting a 5% year-over-year decline in S&P 500 earnings for the fourth quarter. That's according to the data compiled by Bloomberg. Now, in dollar terms, profits from the S&P 500 companies have fallen by about $25 billion compared to the same period last year. And revenues have dropped by much, much more, $287 billion. So it's certainly a drain. It's one of the reasons why the market's been so choppy and really the so far this year, more stocks are down in the S&P than they are up. About 60% of S&P 500 stocks are down 10% or more for the year. About, I think it was 28% are down over 20% are in a bear market this year. So this is a very market that's very narrow. there aren't a ton of winners. And the ones that are kind of expensive. So it's tough. It really is a tough market to make money in. So don't feel bad. There's a lot of hedge funds blowing up. A lot of hedge funds closing. So if you're having trouble, don't feel bad. Just seek some advice and work through it and come out better on the other end. Know that each market is different than the last. Now let's get back to the phones. Doug in San Diego called our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.
I know that you guys do some trading and, you know, you obviously try to buy at buy points and sell points. And I do mostly long-term investing of mutual funds and value stocks. But sometimes I do a little bit of trading. And I'm just curious, when you get to a point where some, you know, stocks are becoming fully valued and maybe you've got, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 months left until you reach the one-year mark, you know, you kind of take a pretty big tax hit in relation to if you waited for the long-term gains. And I just wonder how you guys balance that particular dynamic?
That's a great question, especially now that we're going towards the latter part of the year. And a lot of it depends on what stock it is, how long we've held it. You know, he's talking about the going to a full year is what he's talking about. If you hold the stock for past a year, you take profits on it, you're taxed at the long-term capital gains rate. But if you're below, you know, not quite to that 1 year and you take profits, well, you're taxed at your ordinary income tax rate, which is usually higher. So what do? So the stock looks like it's getting a little stretched, maybe a little overvalued. Do you wait a couple months and risk that the stock could come back down and maybe you lose all your profits? Or do you just sell and pay the higher taxes? Well, a lot of it, to me, depends on what your tax bracket is. Is the difference between long-term capital gains and short-term capital gains, is that a 20% difference in your tax bracket? Is it a 5% difference? Because typically, long-term capital gains is about 20% now. If you're in a 25% tax bracket, is that 5% difference that much to add the risk? No, probably not. I just sell it. Is 20% worth it? It possibly could. And then it comes down to what's the stock? How volatile is it? How stretched is it technically? Does it look really precarious? That, oh my God, this thing's gone up and up and up, and it's really overbought on a longer term. I'm not talking about daily. You know, stocks get overbought daily pretty easily. I'm talking about weekly. You know, a stock like Amazon or Google right now, those are very overbought on a longer time frame. Remember I talked about earlier in the show about the longer the time frame, the more important that is? Well, same thing happens with being overbought or oversold. Amazon, Google are extremely overbought on a weekly basis. Could they go higher? Sure. But they're overvalued and they're very overbought. So in that case, I would be taking some profits. Now, if it's a telecom company or it's a consumer staples company that typically aren't that volatile, then I'd probably wait the extra couple months, get some dividends in, and wait till that full year. So it just kind of depends on who you are. Let's go to Vijay in Fremont. How you doing, Vijay?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I have a question on a follow-up what you mentioned just now.
Mm-hmm.
You said that Amazon is taking their market from other retailers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Other retailers were making money on the similar products before.
Yep.
So is Amazon not able to make money? Is their business model does not allow them to make money? How it is sustainable in the long run?
Their margins on their e-commerce business is very small. For example, their net margins for their business. Now, this isn't breaking out their Amazon Web Services, which is more profitable than their sales business. But their net margins are about 0.33%. So 0.3%. Okay. So go for it.
Yeah, but the same thing, when Walmart sells the product, they were able to make much more than that before, right?
Yes.
So now how it is possible that then this model of Amazon may not sustain over a period of time?
I wouldn't say it's not sustainable. It's just that they're making less margins in their business than, say, think of Nordstrom's, for example, which is one of the stocks that has really been gotten killed. Their net margins have historically been around 5 or 6%, which for a retailer, that's about right. Okay. Amazon's less than 1%. Walmart historically has been about 3-3.5%. And obviously they're a low cost retailer. So what Amazon is doing is they're stealing market share. They're stealing business from these other retailers, but they're not making quite as much on it, right? Does that make sense?
Okay.
So they're kind of squeezing the profit out of being a retailer. And that is not one of the big reasons why all these other retailers are having troubles, because I think it's now 45% of consumers, when they're looking to go shop, they immediately turn to Amazon. And Amazon typically is the lowest cost out there.
Yeah. So basically, consumers are the biggest benefiter of that.
Oh, yes. The consumer is benefiting. Absolutely. Makes it, we don't have to drive to the mall. You don't have to spend any gas money to go drive to the mall. Yeah, you might not get it right away, but if you're an Amazon Prime member, which I am, I've been for a while, there's a lot of people that are, comes to you in 2 days. Most things you don't need that day, right? It's helping consumers, absolutely, but it's hurting a lot of the big box retailers, which have a much bigger overhead than Amazon, right? Amazon, they own warehouses and distribution, and they obviously have to keep up their website, and they have engineers for that, but a big box retailer, you have to rent a big store, you have employees, you have liabilities, you have all these things that really add up, and that is why it's easy, but Amazon's been able to undercut a lot of prices out there, and so it's been squeezing that profitability out of the big retailers.
All right. Thank you, Jason.
No problem, VJ. Thanks for calling. That's a great question. Glad I could kind of expand on that a little bit more, because it's something to understand, think about, and one reason why all these big box retailers are really having some trouble. Now it's time for InvestTalk 101, how to remove barriers to investing success. And I talked earlier about these barriers, and there are actions you can take to overcome them. Now first is to put together an action-oriented plan. Now, here are 7 steps to removing these barriers and creating that plan. First is to learn how to monitor your performance. Measuring your performance creates a track record of what has worked and what has not. Allows you to identify the problems that you had and repeat them, or not repeat them, and hopefully repeat the habits that made you successful. Now, this record will be very useful in assessing which investing activities over time can be identified as successful instead of just what you think. You have hard data. Number 2, identify what you want to change. Examine your past trading activity and look for patterns that point to barriers to success. Do you impulsively buy the hot stock that you saw online or on TV, or that your friend or family member suggested without doing much homework? How did that work out for you? Not just over the first week or two or a few months, over the life of holding that stock. Number 3, stay focused on what you need to change. Changing one's behavior requires a focus on what you seek to change. And if you feel you're not focused on how to change your behavior, take a break from investing until you regain that focus. You have the time and the mental ability to go at it again. Number four, determine how you'll deal with the losses. Losses are part of investing. Learn how to deal with them is one of the cornerstones of being a successful investor. Number five, become an expert at one investing strategy. Understand what type of investor you are. You don't need to know how to be a trader and how to be a buy and hold investor and how to be a day trader and how to be an income investor, how to be a growth investor. Figure out what fits your temperament, your personality, and develop a proven investing strategy around it and the knowledge base around it. Number six, learn to think in probabilities. The market is always about probabilities. You always have to assess risk versus reward. Every company has risk versus reward. This is why we talk about. Understand the risks that are involved with every asset you're investing in, but also understand the reward. Too often, people think about one or the other. And then you weigh, is this worth the risk for the potential reward? You know, a big growth stock, there's big upside, but there's big downside because if that growth wanes or there's some problems with their business model, obviously the stock can go down big. Just like a big blue chip stock, like think of just Procter & Gamble, their business really isn't going anywhere. It might go up or down incrementally, but the downside is somewhat minimal compared to, you know, most stocks. But their upside is also somewhat minimal compared to most stocks. So what is right for you? Right for what you need, what you're looking for, what your goals are. Then number seven, learn to be objective. Now, many investors want to believe that the market will do what they think it should do rather than what it actually does. So don't get stuck on what you think it should do. Now, that's Invest Talk 101. Take a systematic approach to removing the barriers, and eventually you will succeed. So there's a link to this article about barriers to investing success next to our main talking point on investtalk.com. Now, 888-99-CHART is how to reach me. As we move into the final segment of Invest Talk for the day, why not bring your question to us? We only have about 7 minutes left in the show. We want to hear from you. I'm registered investment advisor and licensed real estate agent, Justin Klein. Give me a call, 888-99-CHART.
Now is a good time to call Invest Talk.
Do we have a disadvantage, us investors, on the West Coast as opposed to the people that are closer to the action? They're right there in New York.
And what's your question? 888-99-CHART is how to reach Justin right now on Invest Talk. Our podcast distribution is made possible each day by KPP Financial, Steve Peasley, President. If you haven't signed up to be an Invest Talk insider, you're missing out on a whole library of recorded Invest Talk webinars. And soon we'll have the latest webinar, Building a Strong Portfolio with Less Risk and Finding Strong Dividend Paying Stocks, online for you to watch when you're ready. Just sign up for free on investtalk.com.
Hey, Andy from Redondo Beach here. Hey, really enjoyed the podcast, learning a lot. I know you said any question is a good question, but this is really a basic one. I'm a new investor, doing pretty good, I think. You know, I got a 23% return right now. But I do got a question about doing research on a stock. Is it appropriate or inappropriate to call the investor relations department and, you know, maybe talk with the CFO about what's going on with a company? You know, I'm trying to do as much research in stocks before I buy them as I can, and, you know, I'm really dying to know what's going on with one particular company, PRTS. So let me know what you think about the stock itself and, you know, whether it's okay to call the company and ask them if they got anything new coming up the pipeline. All right. Thanks a lot for all your help. Bye.
There's nothing wrong with picking up the phone. Yeah, every public company as some sort of investor hotline. Now, are you going to get through to the CFO? Unlikely. This is a small company. PRTS is U.S. Auto Parts Network. They distribute aftermarket U.S. parts and repair information through a network of websites to individual consumers. And it's only an $80 million market cap company, do about $70 million in sales per quarter. You can call them up and talk to their investor relations department, but you as an individual investor, getting to the CFO is probably not likely. But like I said, this is a small company. Now, the average company, you're almost definitely not, unless you're an analyst. You know, CFOs are busy. They really only talk to big Wall Street analysts usually. So, but there's nothing wrong with picking up the phone. Now, let's take a look at the numbers of PRTS. The return on equity is negative. Their net margins are about negative 1%. That's improving. It has improved over time. But, you know, I'm not a big fan of it. Their profitability is kind of all over the place. They haven't really made money since 2010. From a price to sales perspective, they're cheap. But from an earnings perspective, they're not. They have a decent amount of debt, and it's been increasing. Their financial leverage is increasing. Operating cash flow is all over the place. I wouldn't buy it. You know, the chart doesn't look terrible, but there's no profits really to speak of. So I would stay away from PRTS, but feel free to give them a call. Pick up the phone. Now let's talk quickly about the death of American Mall. Macy's and Nordstrom's came out with earnings last week, and they were dire, to say the least. And really, this is a good example of creative destruction. Steve talks about it all the time. I talk about it regularly. And it's really about understanding paradigm shifts that happen in certain industries and why a stock can look cheap, but in reality, they're not, because there's a paradigm shift in the industry, and the business model is either greatly impaired or is going to be obsolete in due time. And really what's happening is consumer behavior and is changing, and retail commerce is changing. Now, back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, the thing to do was to go to malls. You know, young adults, teens, they would get together and go shopping, check out the latest record, eat. It was a place to be. But that's no longer the case. Smartphones, like the iPhone, helps you keep in touch with your friends. You don't need to get together at a particular place. You get together in a group chat or a video chat. You want to go see a movie? You don't need to go to the mall anymore. You can download it, watch it at home. Now, and then traditional malls, they were built on anchors at the end of the store. Remember? Sears, JCPenney, Bloomingdale's, Macy's, Nordstrom. It's no longer needed anymore. In fact, there's evidence shows that malls with Apple retail stores do the best because they drive traffic. These big box retailers aren't driving traffic anymore. You're not getting any special deal, usually. Costs aren't especially spectacular, and you can get all the selection that you want online. So you don't need a big box retailer. And obviously, consumers are astute. They, like I said before, 44% go to Amazon immediately when they're thinking about shopping. Figure out what the lowest price is. So people need to waste time driving there. It's really changed the dynamic. So when you're investing in the retail space or even in real estate, real estate investment trusts who own these type of facilities, know that there's a lot of issues and you need to be aware of that. Now our hour is up. Maybe there's a question that you didn't get a chance to ask during the program. You can still get it to us. Our anytime number is 888-99-CHART. Leave your question and we will answer it on the next InvestTalk. I'm registered investment advisor Justin Klein. And for Steve Peasley and everyone at KP Financial, thank you for listening. And we hope you'll join us again on the next InvestTalk.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.